The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, hello, hello. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, and welcome, my friends, to another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. And today I'll be taking you on a journey to the south coast of England, to Portsmouth to be exact, because we will be visiting the Mary Rose Museum. As you will hear, it's a place that I have long wanted to visit because I have heard some extraordinary things about the museum and I really wanted to see it for myself. I can tell you now, my friends, that I was not disappointed. It is one of the most fascinating museums I think I have ever visited and well worth putting on your Tudor itinerary if you are travelling around the UK. Well, we're going to get straight on with the chat today. And in fact, we are going to start with a very short excerpt. And this excerpt comes from a new and immersive experience at the museum, which you will experience for yourself if you visit. It is a chance to be standing on the deck of the Mary Rose as she keeled and was subsumed by the water on that fateful day in 1545. As you listen to this podcast, I hope that you will get the experience that the Mary Rose Museum is almost like a living, breathing time capsule. It's very interactive and multisensorial. And on the day that I visited, it was open to the public, so you will hear the sound of people in the background and also some of the audio, immersive audio experiences that are going on in the museum, which help bring the exhibitions to life. Okay, with that, let's get straight on with today's show and let's time travel briefly back in time to 1545 when the pride of Henry VIII's fleet, the Mary Rose, was sunk just outside the entrance to Portsmouth Harbour.
When their world ended, our story began. A disaster struck the Mary Rose, and she sank in the Solent, only a few miles from where you're now standing.
Well, so here I am in Portsmouth on a glorious sunny day, one of the sunniest probably of the year, and I'm here outside the Mary Rose Museum. At last, I have made it here. It is a place that I've wanted to come to for a long time. And I am joined by my two co-hosts for the day. So Alex.
Hello,
and
Sarah.
John.
Hello there.
Hi. So thank you so much for welcoming me here today and for taking us around the museum, telling us all about the Mary Rose. But before we get stuck in and go inside, perhaps you'd just like to introduce yourself. Alex, can I go to you first?
Yeah, I'm Alex Hildred, so I'm head of research and curator of ordnance and human remains, but I started as a volunteer diver who'd done a degree in archaeology in 1979, so I've sort of grown up with the project from as soon as we went into a large-scale excavation.
Wow, so you've got so much to share. I can't wait for mine for all your information. And John, I know we've met on social media and this is
indeed
the first time face-to-face, so what a pleasure.
Yeah, it is a pleasure indeed for me as well.
So what do you do here, John?
I'm actually a front of house member of staff now. After 2.5 years of volunteering here, I was asked to become a member of staff, and it's a no-brainer.
And very smart you look too, may I say.
Thank you very much.
Good. So I think what we're going to do today is start off by telling the story of the Mary Rose, why she was created and some of her early action that she saw as part of the Tudor Navy, and then maybe talk a little bit about the sinking of the Mary Rose And I know, Alex, you'll be sharing a lot of your info and your insights about bringing up the Mary Rose. And perhaps then finish looking at some of your favourite objects, because I know you've got, how many objects did you bring up with her?
19,000 registered objects, but if you include the timbers and the environmental samples and the human remains, it comes to about 25,000.
Wow. So we're not going to cover all those today, but maybe two or three of your favourites. And then perhaps at the end, we'll have a chance to just say to the listeners what's going on here, because you've got a very special exhibition that you're about to launch, so it'd be lovely to hear about how people can come along and access that. But I will just say, before we go inside, the Mary Rose is open to the public today, so you may hear some background noises around us, but that just adds a little atmosphere, I think.
Absolutely.
So before we go inside, Alex, I know that there is something very special about the building that you want to talk to us about, because we're here, aren't we? We're in historic dockyards here, and just over to my right is a rather magnificent Victory, Nelson's flagship, and then we have the Mary Rose Museum, but architecturally it's quite special. So do you want to tell us about that?
Well, first of all, it's very small, and if you look at the size of it, it's a bit like the Starship Enterprise in wood that's landed. But the reason for that is it actually covers a dry dock, just like the one HMS Victory is in, and the ship inside, the Mary Rose, was brought in on the lifting barge straight into the dockyard, the base that she's in now. So she's in the middle of it, still on the barge that she was brought in on, and or still on the cradle she was brought in on, and the museum is built over her, but it's small because she is the centerpiece of what's basically a critical care unit for the ship and the object. So underneath the floor of the dock are just thousands and thousands of meters of electric cables and conduits that bring the air and the temperature control and everything else to every single case within the museum, and in particularly long galleries that are opposite the ship. So that's why it's a very small shape. And if you look at the buildings within the dockyard, it's not a grand, huge building like the other storehouses, but it's specially created to preserve the Mary Rose.
Well, that makes lots of sense. And thank you for pointing that out, because I just would have never really have guessed. But yeah, so it's built on a dry dock.
Yeah.
Perfect, makes sense. Okay, so let's go inside then, and perhaps we can start to hear a little bit about the story of the Mary Rose and how she came into being. So now we've come inside the museum, and I think we should pause and just maybe reflect for a moment on how the Mary Rose came into being. Who built her, and when, and why?
Well, when Henry came to the throne, he inherited two ships from his father. And said, the first thing he did was to order two ships, the Mary Rose and the Peter Pomegranate, both of which that were built here in Portsmouth. 1510, the keel was laid, and by the end of the following year, she was being towed up to the Thames for fitting out. So it didn't take very long. And he paid for everything on board out of his own purse. So it was one of his favourite ships, if not his favourite ship.
Can I just ask you about the name of the Mary Rose? Because you hear a lot of people saying it was named after his sister, but that's not true, is it? So maybe we could debunk a myth.
It's the Holy Mary and the Tudor Rose.
Okay, so after a religious figure, after the Virgin Mary, essentially.
As in the Peter Pomegranate is St. Peter, and the pomegranate is a badge of the House of Aragon. And here is the emblem of the rose,
yes.
The Tudor rose, at the bow of the ship.
That's lovely. So we're looking at a picture of the Mary Rose. Where does this come from? This is a contemporary picture, isn't it?
This was done by a lady called Heather Bowring. And this is a tactile. It is meant for people with impaired sight, impaired vision, and you can touch and feel, and it's a very good way of telling everyone that this museum is actually for all diversities.
And lovely.
We have lights up mornings as well.
Okay, great. Now, why did Henry VIII feel he needed to build more naval ships? You know, as you said, he inherited only two from his father. So why this sudden need to build a navy, do you think?
I think he felt threatened by the French, mainly because he'd already got the port of Calais, and this ship in particular was to start the building of his army at sea. It isn't yet the Royal Navy. It's the army at sea.
But do you think what his intention was to build?
Yes.
Basically a larger fleet that
it
was going
definitely
to...
definitely improve the size of the fleet, yes.
Yeah. How many eventually, how many ships did he build eventually?
There's about 60, 70 ships.
Right, okay, so pretty sizable then.
Yeah.
Absolutely, good. So, so she was built in Portsmouth but fitted out in London. What does that mean exactly, and where was she fitted out?
She would have gone to the Tower of London to get all the guns, which at that stage were on the weather deck and the forecastle and after castles.
What's a forecastle and after castle, for those people who don't know?
That is the bow there, is the forecastle. Later in time it became the forecastle. And the stern castle here, or after castle, is where the troops would be, and there would be guns there as well.
Because I guess there'll be a lot of people who are not familiar with the terminologies associated with ships. So what we're going to do is have a show notes page associated with this podcast, and I'll put a picture that we're looking at here and that you've been pointing to, and perhaps point out some of those features. So if you are listening to this podcast and thinking, what does that mean? Then just check out the link that's going to be in the description associated with the podcast to go and see the show notes, where you'll see a picture of the Mary Rose. And so she did see action, though, because again, there's another myth, isn't there, about the Mary Rose, that she was sunk on her maiden voyage. But again, that's not true, is it?
No, we get that all the time. I think they compare it to the Vasa, or they confuse it with the Vasa in Stockholm.
Oh, so what was the Vasa? Was that a warship
that
of the
was,
same period?
King Gustav, 1628 it was later, sunk on its maiden voyage.
So that's where that confusion happened. So what kind of action did the Mary Rose see?
Well, she took troops from the Thames up to Newcastle for the Battle of Flodden. And as Henry was over in France, so that was the Flodden was governed really by Catherine.
Oh, I didn't realise. So she went up, so she was involved in Flodden.
Yes, so taking the troops there and then returning back to London after the battle. And later on, there was the off the Atlantic coast of France at Brest. There was a battle off of Brest, and that's the battle in which we lost the Regent.
Okay.
And she was involved in that as well.
Okay, so she survived then. And then what else do we know about the rest of her history before we come to that fateful day when she finally sank?
Well, in between time, I mean, there was a lot of time she was actually laid up in ordinary, but basically that means that she's in a dockyard somewhere, not doing an awful lot, probably would have had a skeleton crew. And the other time she would escort merchants up and down the channel. There were obviously pirates around at that time as well, and so she would protect them.
Okay, but a lot of time spent actually not doing a lot rather than
not a great
being
deal.
In action.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And I'm just personally, I'm really curious about the sailors. Where did they come from?
If you're a landsman and you're struggling for food for a family, you will be able to come on board the ship, and you are well fed. They certainly get a lot of protein on board this ship, which we can touch on later on. But it's a very strenuous job.
Mm.
But there was also a camaraderie you could get on board a ship you couldn't get on land.
So, again, I'd love to just debunk some myths, if there are any. Were people forced to be involved in these ships, or were they all people who just, you know, they were signing up because, as you say, it was actually quite a good way of life?
Absolutely. There's no press gangs yet. That doesn't come for a long, long time in history after. These men probably were mostly volunteers. And we're finding out a lot now about the diversity of the crew and where they came from. And so they would have been here because they want to be here.
Yeah. And the age ranges for a typical sailor?
Well, the age range on this ship's from about 12 years old to, I think, about 48.
Wow. And of course, we forget, don't we? They all died much younger, so they were doing adult things at a lot earlier age. But 12 seems like, when you talk about the strength required.
Yeah.
Would they be doing the same kind of job, the sort of 12-year-olds as a grown man, or did they have a specific role within the ship?
I think basically they were there to learn as much as anything, but also they benefited from being paid as well.
Right.
And if you, for example, there could have been orphans on board who would have no other life on land, and this would be a way of them, it's an adventure.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, right, so is there anything else we need to know about the history before we get into, as I say, perhaps the sinking, which is of course why we're here today and why we have the Mary Rose?
Well, basically it's 34 years after she was launched, so she'd been a servant all that time. And there was a refit in 1536, which was a momentous year for Henry.
Yes, indeed.
And for many reasons. And this was one of the first through-deck gunships that were then made. So the decks were reinforced to take the weight of the great guns, and there were gun ports put into the side of the ship. The gun ports could only be opened from the weather deck, lifted open.
So talk to me about the weather deck again. What's the definition of a weather deck?
In between the after castle and the forecastle, okay, is the weather deck.
So it's the middle bit
of the
ship.
It's the middle bit that isn't, it's lower than the front and the back.
Yeah, I see that. Okay.
Over the top of all of that, there is an anti-boarding net, which over here we have the last fragments of the actual anti-boarding net.
Oh my word,
net.
You do. Should we go and have a look at that?
That's...
So we're looking at an exhibit here of a lattice work of yes, rope, yep, or net, as you were saying. And this is original to the Mary Rose. So what is this, and why was it used?
It's to stop people from boarding your ship. It's to keep them off, basically.
So anybody who's attacking the ship, who might want to jump from one ship to the other, this would stop them actually getting into the ship.
It would deter them, and you'd then have to deal with people with pikes and boarding pikes and
sticking it up through the nets. Oh yeah, ouch. But this is really relevant because we were having a chat on Clubhouse recently with one of your divers, Kester, who was making the point, and I didn't realise just how important or significant the anti-boarding net was in terms of how many people lost their lives.
It's the juxtaposition of having an anti-boarding net means you can't get off. That's not to say that tunas could probably swim. There was very little leisure time to learn to swim. Unless you were born by the sea and you were used to the water, a lot of these men just would have perished anyway, because right, they can't swim.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow.
We do have it etched onto the glass of one of the floors, which you can then judge for yourself how,
okay,
that would have felt.
Well, I know the Mary Rose ship is behind me, and I've purposely not been looking because I want to just take it in its full sort of glory when I turn around. maybe, though, it would be good now just to talk about the sinking, when it happened and why it happened.
Well, there are a lot of different ideas as to why the Mary Rose sank. We're in a gallery which actually shows, and perhaps we should go over there, the battle at the time. So we're in Portsmouth, we're in Old Portsmouth, which is to the right of the picture in the harbour. The harbour entrance, you can see, is quite narrow.
Yes.
The English fleet has just gone out, so this is July the 19th, 1545. Yes. And this is a copy of an engraving that was made by the Society of Antiquaries in the 1770s, which was a copy of a painting that was in Cowdray House that sadly burnt down. So it's absolutely fortuitous, but it is just the whole battle scene. You've got the round tower, which is defending the entrance to the harbour. That's still there, so you can walk along there. The square tower, where we have weddings and various other things, so that's still there. The gun platform, you can walk along as part of the ramparts around Portsmouth. This is the old town, and the cathedral, the church, is just visible
yes,
at the entrance to that. And then moving along towards the east, you've got one of Henry's castle. We call it Southsea Castle, but then it was called the South Castle. And that was one of the ones that he built at the very end, towards the very end of his reign in the 1530s, because the war with France, everything that was going on with France and Spain was building up. And so he increased his navy quite dramatically during that time. So from very few ships, four, as we said at the very beginning with the two, and then the Mary Rose and the Peter Pomegranate, it was 53 by the time he died. And he reinforced a load of castles and did work on them, and Southsea Castle was one of the ones that was done in 1544. And what you see in front of you here are the sort of 60 vessels, so it's not just the royal fleet or his army by sea, led by the then flagship, which is the Grâce Dieu, but also any additional vessels that are brought in specifically for that. So he got about 60, and we've got the Isle of Wight in front of us, and you can see four galleys, so they're rowed, or they have the capability of rowed with one sail if you want to put up, whereas our great ships all require sail. So on that morning of July the 19th, there'd been a skirmish the night before, but nighttime put an end to the battle, which is quite common. You'd stop at night. And it started again in the morning, but all morning the fleets, both of them, were unable to move because there was a lack of wind. Towards the late afternoon, there was wind that came off the land, which still happens in the summer. You get this hot wind that comes down. And so the English would be able to move, and the French are still anchored off St. Helens on the Isle of Wight. And interestingly, one of the things we're doing in this image, you can see a vessel that's just sunk, one of their ships, and we're going to do some magnetometry looking for possibly remains of that.
Oh,
yeah.
Later,
next week, 7th of August.
Oh my goodness, we might have a Mary Rose all over again.
Well, it'll be one of the French galleys, probably a Venetian galley, but
yeah.
So the action is happening here, and you saw before the only image of the Mary Rose afloat with the big castles on either end. And that's taken from a roll of all 53 of the king's ships. So he could literally, it was divided into three parchment rolls, each of which was 12 feet long, and he could unroll them in front of people and say, this is my army. And what's more, below each one, you've got the list of the weapons on board, which was critical for us because it's one of the ways we identified the Mary Rose, because the number of guns matched the inventory. So he could just say, don't mess with me, I've got this huge fleet. And this is the fleet that he's got here. So with the Grasdieu, the Mary Rose, so this is the second image of the Mary Rose. You can just see her masts with the fighting tops and the few people that are standing on them. And then people in the water with small boats, the ship's boats have come out. You can also see how close it is to Southsea Castle.
Yes.
It's within a mile and a half. Well, across to Ryde is no distance at all. People swim it, people kayak it. Unfortunately, it's right in the middle of a shipping channel,
right.
So it's not brilliant. But he could hear the screams of the people singing. The Mary Rose sinking and people drowning from where he was on Southsea Castle. You can see he's on his horse here. And what's more, as a historical image, we can identify by going up close and looking at what people are wearing or what they're carrying many of the items we see here. So this is the closest we have to the Dutch painter Bruegel, which does sort of street scenes, and you can identify objects. But most of the art at this time, as well as you know, is all the fineries. It's all the really posh people. Whereas we've got everyday life, they're sort of hog roasts going on. You've got people marching up, archers marching up, carrying their longbows with arrow bags, and we've got an arrow bag like that. So it's a beautiful image. But on that day, the fleet was going out, that the Grasdieu was supposed to be leading it, the Mary Rose was second behind it in the van, one of the two other ships leading one of the wings. And she came up, and for some reason, we don't know, she engaged the French fleet, and we have an eyewitness account from somebody who's reporting to Charles V, so reporting the whole incident, because they were trying to get a peace treaty, basically, and this was sort of the last bit. Henry VIII had besieged Boulogne the year before and recaptured it, so this was like a French retaliation with 220 ships, so larger than the Spanish Armada of 41 years later, coming to get Portsmouth, the major naval base, and take out the English fleet in their home port. And so they had the advantage during the day of the galleys being able to row in and take pot shots at the English fleet that was becalmed and guarding the entrance to Portsmouth Harbour. And sometime towards evening, as I say, there was a wind and the fleet started to move. The Mary Rose engaged. This account says she fired the guns on one side of the ship and then turned to fire the guns on the other, which is one of the maneuvers it's done, and sank on the side of the guns that she, the same side as the guns had been fired. And interestingly, when we found the ship, it took years of just following from one timber to another to get the outline, and then it was decided, this was in the 70s, to put trenches at either end to try and work out which was the bow and the stern. And it absolutely amazed, the ship is pointing back into Portsmouth Harbour rather than going out, which is what we expected. And so that ties in really well with that idea that she was going out and fired the guns. And then when we excavated the guns that we raised inside the bore, some of the ones on the starboard side had no shot in them, so they had been fired, because you automatically reload after engaging. staging, yet all the ones that were recovered on the port side that we recovered and that had been recovered in the 19th century by salvage divers who worked a bit on the ship did still have their shot in them. So that also suggests that she fired some of them. But other ideas are that the French immediately said, we have sunk the Mary Rose. So there's that we have to contend with. We put this entire image, which, as I said, had still got buildings that are around today and on the Isle of Wight and the position of the Mary Rose is known, into a digital terrain model so you can work out the rough distances. And we do have gun distances listed in 1627 for the types of guns we've got. We also replicated and fired two different types of guns, so we know the maximum distance. And she's within 1,200 meters, which is good enough for the biggest, the long-range guns to actually hit. So we can't find any evidence of being hit, but then we haven't got a complete ship. But on the other hand, we know that she was within range. So that's still in the mix. It's still in the mix. And what's more, when we see the ship, well, I'll tell you the story later when we see the ship. But so those are some of them. The other ones are things like, oh, the gun ports were too low, because they were probably, the gun ports were put in when the deck was strengthened in the 1530s. And those gun ports were cut, but the interesting thing is they had lids, but we don't know how they opened and closed them because they're very new. So unlike the Vasa, which is a newer ship than the Mary Rose, but some, 100 years, 80 years newer.
And that's what we were just talking about, that did sink.
That did sink. The way of opening the ports was really well defined. Ours wasn't. And there's all sorts of things that suggest it's quite experimental and new. So when we found the gun port lids on the starboard side, when we were tunneling under the ship to put the salvage cables in, tie them through to the bottom of the ship with bolts, we found gun port lids open above those ports. So the gun ports were open, and yes, the position is such that if you heel to over 19 degrees, and we've done this in tank trials, water comes in there. And once it comes in, of course, the ballast is shingle ballast, just like pebbles. There are very few divisions in the hold, so there's not compartments like modern ships that you can isolate. There are a few, but not many. That would have a momentum once it got wet. And so you're almost in a situation you can't get out of. That compounded with a wind, because if you're turning, you're putting all your sail up and you're moving your sail, so you're in an awkward position. If the wind gets that and just pushes the sail over, you're again exacerbating it. So it's probably a whole mix of different things.
There was storm of factors.
Perfect storms, maybe too many people has been suggested, but we know that 500, a crew of 500, there were 415 listed as the soldiers, mariners, and gunners, but then you'd had all the officers with their entourages, some of them that would have been the younger page-type people that are some of our perhaps 12-year-olds. Some of them are associated with nicer clothes than the normal mariners would have, and their muscles aren't as developed because they're quite young. So it's 500 is about right, and we've got remains of 179, which is about half. And when you think that the only way out is from the top of the castles, and those areas, as you go up through the four decks and the fifth deck in the bow and the stern, is a very small area, because you're getting from a ship that's only 12 meters wide in the middle. As you go up, the side of the ship curves in, and so that space is less. So we worked out that probably only about 50 would be between those two areas. So those would have jumped off easily, and then the netting would have stopped the rest of them. And it really is difficult. I mean, the net's the size of your finger, and that's a rope like that with the distance between the diamond that's created no more than the length of your hand. So it's smaller than your hand. So there's no way you could get out without cutting your way. Now, the sad thing is, we're in 12 meters of water here. The width of the Mary Rose is nearly that. So the people on her would have seen the light, and you would have been able to walk on the side of the hull, the port side, for a certain period until it starts to disintegrate. And that then in time disintegrated, and we'd only got half a ship, which became sealed. And the reason why it was sealed is because we found the gun port lids had fallen down from the port side, and they were open as well because the inner sides were uppermost when we excavated. So we know those were open, and they survived because there's so much iron in them to bolt through them. And so because the Mary Rose is pointing into the harbor and the tides go across the wreck, every time they meet an obstacle, they drop the sediment. And there's so many around the Solent, so many rivers that come into it with this fine riverine sediment, that it seals it like butter nearly. It's like butter with a little bit of flour in it, and you can cut it like slightly melted butter, not hard butter. And that is like a cold cream. It preserves the ship, it really does. So that's why we have half a ship. And that's the story of the sinking, with the various different ideas. Overgunned, no, because we've got less than the inventory, and we would have had more.
How long did it take to sink, do we know? know? How long did they have?
Well, it says minutes, and it probably was, because it literally just rolled over. It's not a Titanic moment,
yeah.
Although it would be equally nasty for the crew on board, especially because they were, you know, within view of the king, you know, and everybody there, their families might have been there. But Henry VIII took such a great interest in it and had followed it throughout its entire life that he immediately said, we've got to salvage it. And again, he authorized all the payments. And it was at a critical time because the French were still wanting to fight, and the fight went on for a few days. And the Charles Brandon, who's a master of the land forces, said, sir, you know, do you realize we have to take 4 ships out of service, out of the fleet, just to try and attach ropes to the Mary Rose. The idea was to attach ropes to the foremast and pull her up. And so you needed 4 boats, and it will be a great weakening to the Navy at this time. But they do that, and there are all sorts of letters back and forth from him to the King saying, this is what we've done so far, the Italian divers have attached it. And then at the end of August, they say, we cannot save her because the rope on the foremast has broken. We have broken her foremast. And then when we found in 2003, the front timber of the ship that curves up and forms the front of the ship,
yes.
It had broken and just where the foremast was, so yeah. There are all sorts of things like that. And that is then compounded by the fact, and this is where history is so exciting and comes into it, that one of the researchers who'd done work for the book on weapons and the history of the ship was working in the Hatfield archives on William and Mary and found a bundle of papers that he said, this isn't William and Mary. They'd put a question mark 1547 on it in pencil on the whole bundle. This is Henry VIII. You've got the battle fleet for the Battle of the Solent listing the captains and various other things. And there was a letter there regarding 3 ships, one of which was the Mary Rose. And it was from shipwrights writing to the king, answering the king, saying, sir, we cannot put big brass guns in the front of the Mary Rose because it's not wide enough there to do it. What's more, there are 2 iron guns in that position. And if we do it, we'll have to take out the foremast, and it will be a great and the step for it, and the riding bits, which is what the anchor is attached to, big, big structure. That will be a weakening to the ship, a big weakening to the ship at that point. So we don't know. This is dated possibly just before the battle, sometime early in 1545. But in late 1545, what we do know is the other 2 ships that were mentioned are in Portsmouth Dockyard having that work done. So had the king had his way and they'd done it, perhaps that weakened the ship as well. But that's a new thing. But what's more, that specifically said, and also in her after castle, the Barbican, which is at the very back of the middle of the ship, there are 2 culverins, 2 big bronze guns, and then on the decks above, sakers, which are smaller bronze guns, both long range, and they're situated at the middle of the ship firing forwards. And that meant we had to completely revise what we thought of the structure and put a second castle deck on the front and the back, and that was as late as 2007. So we're constantly finding things.
Still learning.
And this is where things like digitization of archives, which are happening all over, are going to come with some things that we add to the story. So it's not finished yet, there's so much.
Okay.
So that's the Battle of the Solent for you.
Well, thank you, that's amazing. So I'm just going through now into the main deck. Well, oh my God, holy moly. That is seriously impressive. So I've come into this glass gallery. This is the dry dock in front of me where the ship is. And yeah, I can see there's like a hologram of a guy right on the top of the deck calling out. But what a structure. It's massive. That is truly so much bigger than I expected it to be. And more of it.
There's about 43% of the ship there.
This is a stern. That's the rudder down there that we took off underwater.
Okay.
So those are the gun ports on the main gun deck, which is... You see there's a pole going from the end of the ship at the stern. And that's the main gun deck with these ports that were put in perhaps quite late in the life of the ship. So that's the main gun deck. Below you've got a storage deck and then the hold at the very bottom where this ballast would have been.
I see, right.
You can see 3 of the frames of the ships, like the ribs, so that the ship is built with these ribs making the main part of it, with outer planking on the outside and inner planking on the inside, so 3 layers of it. You can just about see that. Those are the tops of the timbers that were first seen in 1916.
So really the ones that have the little red
tags on them. 1971 when the ship was first seen, and then following around, you could see you could get a boat shape, and then as I said earlier,
so it was all buried except and you had to literally excavate all of that
all
out.
By hand. Well, we used basically underwater vacuum cleaners to take away the stuff we didn't want, but you didn't use them as digging objects. You just fed very carefully the unwanted sediments up through them.
And how long did it take to excavate? Remind me.
Well, the early trenches to define the shape of the ship and what was there happened between 1971 and 1979, but it was only like weekends or maybe one week a year with a team of very small people. In 1979, it was decided that enough of the structure was exposed to suggest at least three decks, and at that stage, Dr. Margaret Rule came and joined the project as lead archaeologist and said, we're going to do an open area excavation. We're going to open the whole of the ship from bow to stern and dig everything out and make trenches, sensible trenches, like you do on a land site, and put a grid over the entire lot with the poles going over the divisions between the decks. And that you needed because you could only work on one side of the ship when the tide was going one way. Otherwise, your airlift spoil would end up back to you. You had to go with the flow of the tide.
It must have been incredibly difficult. And I see you have this film playing, don't you? So we can see the characters who would have been on board ship and what they're doing. So that helps bring the object to life.
The characters are set in particular areas, and those are the people that we think were in them. So we've got a surgeon, we've got a master, we've got a gunner's cabin, we've got the purser's cabin with barrels and people weighing stuff out. We've got in the stern castle, people playing musical instruments and reading books, because that would have been the officers' area. And then in the galley, in the bottom of the ship, was this brick galley, and there's a cook cooking on it. So it's all faithful, depending on what was found in there. So the replicas that we use were actually copies of objects that were found there. And then you turn round, and you've got a walkway down the middle between galleries on one side and the ship, and you see some of the objects that were in that space opposite.
So across the other side of the glass gallery, you brought me to the view of the main gun deck, basically. So you can see right down the length of it, can't you, with all the guns. And these are genuine guns from the ship.
Everything behind glass is real, and every single glass area has got its own environment, which is maintained, as does the big ship hull. So, you know, that's half of the money that we get for entrance is actually maintaining the environment, because, of course, once you disturb these objects, once you lift them, they're your responsibility forever, which is why so few shipwrecks are lifted, you know, archaeologically, because you've got all of these objects that you have to pay for and care for. And for us, that's even things like the 700 logs that could have been burnt in the galley the next day, but we, you know, register them, keep them in environmentally safe conditions. But yes, so it's actually quite an engineering feat to A, remove the guns from underwater, because they were at their ports going through them, and then also in here to put the guns on the original carriages. You know, that's our heaviest gun, 2.8 ton gun, and it's on a four-wheeled trucked carriages with these four truck wheels with cheeks on either side, fitted exactly to the size of the gun, and that's not resting on it. It's resting over on it with very special mounts that are made so you can't see them. So
the only things that aren't real
are perspex, and we use perspex for where we've got something, for example, an incomplete object that you wouldn't understand if you weren't making it complete, or for the blade of a bladed instrument when you've just got the handle, and we've got lots of handles of knives and swords.
Yes.
So perspex or steel mounts that are pretty well hidden.
Thank you.
got about 380 shoes, out of which 70 are pairs, but there are so many different styles. And some of them are early 16th century, some of them are Saxon styles that have gone on for a long time, and then some are ankle boots or thigh boots.
Yes.
And it's, you could have a Tudor fashion show. And again, these are everyday things, not the most expensive top of the range things. Some of them might have been.
No, but that is the beauty of this museum, isn't it? And that's what everybody talks about. It's a real replica of Tudor life, of everyday Tudor life.
If you look at us and how much we have Costa coffee cups, and you think, what would happen if you didn't have Costa coffee cup or we didn't represent it? It wouldn't be representative of the way we live, walking around with coffee cups.
Yeah.
And it's the same with this. You've got the equivalent of the everyday things that we take for granted,
yeah.
And it's been miraculously preserved.
Yeah.
And so it gives us a far better, you know, real glimpse into real life rather than life as would be portrayed, because even if you're excavating a skeleton and inhumation, the objects that are there are the ones that were chosen to go with it. This is an accidental catastrophe with this wonderful selection of organic material, the bone and the leather preserved, and that is the everyday stuff that, without being sorted, the only sorting is what the tides have done and what we have done in excavating, or the Tudor salvage have done, or the people who worked in the 19th century.
Okay, so you were talking before about bodies that have been salvaged.
179 men, and they're all males, and one dog. So we're now looking at the... And our dog is the most complete skeleton. Can you guess maybe what sort of type of dog you might have been by the size? You can see everything is... It's only a few of the toe bones.
Yeah, he looks like a large terrier or something
it
like
is.
That.
It is. So we've done the genetics on him. We've got genomic DNA, so we can say that he is definitely male. We can say he's recessive for a disease we didn't even know was around. It's like gout for dogs, and we thought that it was due to the inbreeding that we do now with good dogs, especially like Dalmatians suffer with it. But he's recessive for that gene, so that's a coat hanger for a disease. We can tell that he's 18 months old by a whole load of different things, his teeth, his bones, fusing, or whatever. But the genomic DNA says that his closest relative today would be a Jack Russell, with the mother perhaps being a greyhound or whippet, which is sort of what he is.
I
you said
see
it's
that.
Terrier.
Yes, it's a, yeah.
But and then the morphology, the head structure, when you compare it, because he was a very well-traveled dog. He's had a CAT scan for his bones, which I think is quite funny. And his skull went to the Royal Veterinary College to study and compare with all the others, and they said it must be some sort of whippet cross with something else, greyhound whippet, another
huge,
form of dog.
Huge, great, big, long legs of a whippet, yes.
Yeah, but he was found just outside one of the three cabins on the main deck that we had, with a sealed door, with a door that was still in its runners. It was partially open, and there was a little wedge in it. The first thing, object that you could see was a hanging lantern. So actually, the only two lanterns that weren't in store, one of them was here in the carpenter's cabin, the other was with the cook in the galley. So that gives you an idea of how important they are. But the other things that we found, that leads into the 179 people. So having successfully done the genomic DNA of the dog, we have tried on a number of individuals. This is very expensive, it takes time, it regards extracting a sample, so you want to be very careful, because you're taking a bit of the bone away. Usually we use a teeth at the moment, so you're sacrificing a teeth. And we looked at 8 individuals and looked at the isotopes, which are the chemicals that are in the drinking water and the food you eat, that are also a clue of where you were brought up. Recently we did that on 8, and we found that 3 individuals were born outside of England, and one of them we ran the genomic DNA on because his skull morphology looked as though he could be African.
Mm-hmm.
And his father was definitely from North Africa, and he's a Mozabite individual from North Africa. So, you know, we're getting as close to that. Really diverse crew. And the carpenter, whose chest we look at the moment, you can see he's got a...
What a wonderful
backgammon set. I know. And it was like that, but it was closed, and we didn't know what it was. And when it was opened in the finds bay, we saw all these counters, but they're not all of the counters. So, of course, we looked through every environmental sample we'd taken to see if we could find the rest of them. And then we came to the conclusion it must have been in the cabin because somebody else, one of the officers, wanted more counters, and that's why we didn't find them.
But it's beautifully preserved.
So it's, as I say, one of three cabins on the main deck, but this is one of the chests in it. And interestingly, within this chest, and you can see it's got lots of pewter objects belonging to an officer, and things like a sundial, a lovely wooden box to take a sundial.
So it's almost like their what version of a watch, basically.
Yeah, or a lady's compact or whatever. But the other thing, it's showed of it here, it looks like a black corroded lump, but it's actually Spanish coins. And so when we ran the isotopes on the carpenter, because the way that we've designed this part of the museum is we have cases where we've got objects that are associated with an individual who we think we can tell what their occupation was. So this is the carpenter. But when we looked at the carpenter's teeth, it transpired that he could have come from anywhere in Iberia. So Spain's as good a thing as any. And we've got a cluster of Spanish coins in his...
So we can surmise then that was it particularly sailors who moved around to find work and trade, or do you think this was just reflective of Tudor society or 16th century society in general?
I think it's a bit of both. We also found Spanish adzes. I mean, very typically, the Spanish were far more advanced than the English in deep water navigation. So quite often you get the names of navigators who would come on the ship to, as we do now, we have people to take people inside and outside of busy ports. So you've got a pilot and a navigator, or sometimes both, and they quite often Spanish. In 1513, we had a Spanish surgeon on the Mary Rose. Unfortunately, at this date, we don't have the names of individuals. We don't have that historical information. Maybe we'll get it, you know, in an archive somewhere still. But I think that it's a bit of both. It reflects the fact that England was some places were very cosmopolitan. And also that people of certain skills were brought in. So all of the surgery equipment was brought in from German, the Low Countries. And so it's not unlikely that perhaps a surgeon was as well. But we don't know. We don't have a body that we can convincingly say is a surgeon. So I think John is going to talk to you about one of the other people within this case,
within
this area. So this area is the men of the main deck, which is a surgeon, because we had a surgeon's cabin, the master gunner, because we had an area with gunnery equipment and a chest, and then the carpenter that we've seen.
This cabinet that you're looking at now is we believe is the master gunner's chest in here.
Is it one of your favourites?
It's one of my favourites. There's many.
I can see why, looking at all the objects that are surrounding us. But yes, tell me what we're looking at.
There's so much in the way of personal items here. He has the chest itself. He has small daggers. He has a larger dagger, like a kidney dagger there, number 10. Little files and tiny, tiny dice. So he really small dice.
Tiny, aren't they? And again, just for those people listening, I'm going to be taking some pictures and I'll be putting those in the show notes in the gallery. So if you want to see what we're talking about, just make sure that you follow that link in the description below. So yes, what were you telling me about these?
But there's tiny dice there. There's a linstock there.
What's a linstock?
A linstock is like a slow burning fuse. So if the master gunner is the one that would set the charge, and he would say, have a care, and give fire. And he, at arm's length, he would stretch out, and you've got the extra length there, so he's at a safer distance when he lights the...
That's amazing. And so did each gun have a master gunner? Was there like a set team?
I think each team would have someone who would actually set the fire.
Right.
We have individual linstocks in the gallery just over there on the other display, and they are all hand carved, and they all represent similar objects. There are some that represent other things.
Is it a bit fruity, John? Is that
how they interpret things. This would have a piece of rope coiled around it, soaked in a solution of saltpeter. It would then be lit and it would smoulder, rather like on a bonfire night now, you'd have a long burning fuse. Then through the jaws of that, the smouldering piece would be ready to touch down to the powder.
And I'm drawn by this large trunk behind it and the coat, some kind of coat of arms. Have you found out anything about that?
We cannot.
Oh, no. No. What a shame.
But it's a remarkable piece. I can only imagine the divers, the feeling when you find something like that below water and the yearning to open it up.
I know. I've got chills running down my spine. That's amazing. Is there anything else you want to show us
here? Well, this one in particular would be the Master Gunner's Jerkin. Now, this from here is the Master Gunner's Jerkin, a beautiful thing in itself. It's sheep leather, and it's slightly stained, we believe, possibly, because this is the top of the gunpowder horn, so the powder horn, which hasn't deteriorated, but the horn itself being organic has had a biochemical reaction with the chemicals or whatever in the silt and has disappeared. So that means the gunpowder would have had to come out of that and quite possibly stained the jerkin. But if we come around to the side here, and you see here, there's the humanity of everything we're doing here. That's his ribcage. It has taken on the form of his mortal remains.
Oh my goodness.
With the weight of the silt.
That is quite gory, but you can very definitely see that's the case.
There's a St. George's cross on there, but unfortunately it's almost indiscernible. But you can see it's torn along here, and it would have been stitched on the sides.
Yeah. Good.
There's a knit comb there.
And what's the round object?
The round object is... it's a sundial.
Oh, it's another
it's
kind of...
It's a portable sundial.
They all had their little pocket watches.
Well I think they're the Rolex of the day, really. Yes,
yeah,
I've got
like
this,
it.
But, you know, you can't afford that, but I can.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a status symbol, really.
I think we should all... I think I quite like one of those. Lovely. Anything else you want to show?
Just round the back, just so that you know.
Oh, is this the guns?
This is the face of the Master Gunner recreated. So it brings it to life. This is what a museum is a memorial to all these men who did not come home.
Yeah. But we've been talking about guns quite a lot, and there's a beautiful example, isn't it?
Is
that one of the bronze guns?
That's one of the bronze guns, yes. That isn't in our context gallery, the one that we put most of the guns in, because it's one that had fallen from the port side of the ship and had ended up upside down along the upper gun deck. And this is one from it, he still had Italians that he brought over to England, I mentioned gun founders, and this is their family, the Arcanis family.
So that the name here, we've got an inscription at the bottom, what, Dimicano?
Dimicano. Yeah, with the date.
And what's this inscription?
Poor defender, for defense
of
Henry VIII Rex. But some of them, we've got one on the very upper deck, which has got a wonderful inscription that basically talks about the King Henry VIII being defender of the faith and various other things.
And we've got AD 1535, such a significant year. And what, I mean, it's beautifully cast, isn't it? It's as crisp, the coat of arms with the crown and the Welsh dragon, and I guess that must be the greyhound, maybe, and then the Tudor rose. It looks beautiful.
And it's a very odd shape. You can see it's actually 12-sided.
Yes.
And that, again, is exactly what the pattern that would have been made in wood would have been done that, and that's why you can carve
it's a
all
of
that
art,
in it.
Isn't it
is, but it's also it's a symbol of Henry's power and its status. You know, it's saying some of them say HI, and that's Henricus Invictissimus, you know, most invincible.
Thank you.
You've brought me up into, I think this is the Admiral's Gallery. So what's going on here? I can see lots of pewter plates, but I can also see stuff about skulls and obviously so the genetic research that you've been doing.
Yes, what we've got in the middle of this gallery is a semicircular, or well, nearly circular set of panels which talk about the research that's been undertaken on primarily the teeth of eight of these Mary Rose people, talking about the isotope analysis. So you've got the science mixed with the archaeology, mixed with the fact that we recovered the fact that, or discovered that some of these were foreign, so we talk about that, and other things like the genetics we've done on the cod of the Mary Rose, so suggesting that some of it came from Labrador. So even at that early space, the idea is perhaps we'd used up all the local stuff and we're having to go to Labrador, but it was probably because there were so fish that were so plentiful that they were just jumping on into baskets, which is what you hear when you read about it. So this is a temporary display that can, you know, be taken down if we need to for corporate events. That's what this gallery was designed to incorporate. So you've got these big cases that sweep around the end of each gallery, and that's because we're in a dry dock and it's that shape, and that's exactly why the ship is behind us, and you've got these sweeping areas, not very big, the space is quite constrained, but this again is portable, but it's got a number of different interactive stations, so you can design the dog because of the DNA we've done. You can mix the top of one dog with the bottom of another and play around with it. We've got the Archer Royal, who again we think is from possibly North Africa, who's, you can do different things to change his eye color and his hair color, because we're not yet sure what that was because we haven't finished his genetics. And on Henry, we've got something that explains the DNA and you can go through it. So it's very much interactive. We also looked at the family trees of the only two people who we have names for, Sir George Carew, who's an officer, and George Carew, who is captain, and Roger Grenville, who is an officer. Carew didn't have any family, but Roger Grenville did. And we've been able to find 17 generations down two sisters who are related, and we brought them in and didn't tell them where they were coming and gave it as a surprise that their great-great-great-great-grandfather, 17
really?
Generations, was on the Mary Rose, so they're very good.
We've got Keeping the Faith and Men of Fashion. There's lots of clothing and boots.
Isn't it great?
I would wear those boots.
Oh, so would I. I think we should sell them in the shop. But you can see the styles of shoes and the man bag. You know, that's a man bag.
That's a man bag. I mean, some fantastic leather purses, haven't we? We've got
books.
Book covers.
Pomanders. More of the sundials here.
Lots of sundials. And some jewellery.
Drinking flagons and
they're in a remarkable state, some of them, aren't they? They're the drinking flagons that I'm pointing to at the moment. And again, I'll take some images of these. But they're remarkable quality.
Even with the cork, you know?
Wow. So, let's go ahead. John, you want to tell me something about these plates. There's an astonishing array of pewter plates here.
They all belonged to Sir George Carew. This was his dining set. And there are a number of plates that were missing from the set. And the relevance really here is the ones that are in the corner up here, which have Lord Lyle's emblem embossed into the rim of the plates. Now, the significance of that, the evening before the battle, King Henry called a meeting of his admirals, and it was at that meeting and that meal hosted by Lord Lyle that Henry presented Sir George Carew with a gold bosun's call, which was his badge of office. He promoted him to Rear Admiral of the Fleet. So at that time, the meal was interrupted by the herald saying that the French have anchored off the Wight, and Henry dispatched everyone back. He wanted to go on board the ship, but was ushered to shore, the safest possible place. So either Sir George Carew, the meal was so delicious, he brought them with him. Or maybe he was trying to make his own personal set back up to numbers. But either way, we don't know. It's one of history's little mysteries.
Yeah, but
it's a lovely story.
This is the luxury that the elite of the ship
absolutely
had to
English
enjoy.
Pewter was the finest pewter known, and it was well sought after throughout the known world.
Very nice. And a significant set it is.
But I think also the importance of this is every single one of these now, we know it was on board on July 19th, 1545. So their style, we know, was around at that time. And there are a couple of pewter things that if you saw it before the Mary Rose, you'd say, oh, it's 2 decades earlier.
Okay.
Or 2 decades later.
And that, so it's helped date the style.
And there's so many things. Like this, we've got one sword with a basket hilt. That is now the defining style of the basket hilt in the mid 16th century, and it's almost, it can be like that with every single object because we know that it was around then.
Fantastic. Now we're going to go and have a look at a gun, aren't we?
Yeah, so that's in a very unusual position. It's on the first castle deck. We now know that there were two, but it's pointing forwards at the widest part of the ship. So it's in the middle of the ship, really. But because the ship is so narrow at the bow, it's difficult to put guns firing forward. But at the widest part of the ship, you can do that. We're going through an airlock now, so the sound might change. And this is because we maintain the environment within the big, vast chamber that the ship is in. And once you're here, you can see there's no, unlike the two decks below, there's no glass wall. So you're breathing the same, you're in the same air as a ship. So we have a delay as one door opens and the one door closes and the other opens.
Well, thank you for explaining that. But yes, now we feel really up close and personal with this.
And if you notice, the background noise changes on all levels. So we're now out in the open air. You can hear the sea better, whereas below you hear the creaking of the ship on the decks below. So this is the anti-boarding netting etched onto the glass, and you can see onto the upper deck below, and right the way down, those are ventilation hatches. We've got these big open areas, which would have had hatch covers on them, and that actually allows the smoke from the guns. You can see a main deck gun below that on the main deck, so you can look two decks down, and that allows smoke to come up, but it also allows maybe commands to go up.
What an interesting thing. I never thought about that. But of course, if you're firing guns in an enclosed space, it would be
that
horrendous, wouldn't it?
It's dreadful. But you can see just pointing out through this front of the stern castle. So we're now at the beginning of the castle at the stern of the ship. So you can see it's actually quite a long area. And if you look at the ship itself, we've got one deck there, but there would have been a second deck. So it would have come nearly to the top of this building. And a lot of the area on the would have been officers' quarters, as well as action stations for things like pikes and bills. But this gun is pointing out through the front of it, and it's angled, and that's how we found it. And it's angled so that if you actually stand here and look at it, you'd see it misses the bow of the ship. So it's firing forward at slight angle to act as a bow chaser, but it's in the middle of the ship. And people said, no, you can't possibly have it. And there it was, in position in its port, with the muzzle going out through the port.
And that's how it was. And look at that gun. That's amazing.
And you can feel the inscription.
So we've got the inscription. This is the actual inscription on the gun, which says, Henry VIII, by the grace of God, King of England and France, Defender of the Faith, Lord of Ireland, and on earth, the supreme head of the English Church. That amazes me that they could be bothered to put that on a gun. But as I was saying before, this gun, more than the one that we're looking at before, is, as you were saying, a complete work of art.
It is, and it's cut, and it says, furthermore, it says the sons of an English made this gun. So by this stage, they're saying, you don't have to import guns anymore. You don't have to import foreigners. We have the capability.
Made in England. Made in England. I love it.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. I love that. I love the casting. It's absolutely exquisite.
But here we've got an area of a reinforced glass floor.
I've got to try and walk on glass. I can see straight down through my feet. Oh, my goodness me.
So what we're looking at is the upper deck in the stern of the ship, where some of the archery equipment, which was actually stored two decks below in a bigger store, have been brought up for the battle. And in fact, you can see that these longbow chests from the Tower of London, and the ones that were complete when we brought them up from the storage deck, had 50 longbows in them. Now, before the Mary Rose, there were only three definite Tudor longbows, and those were actually found on the Mary Rose in the 19th century. And we have, I think it's about 178, 130 of them complete. So you can look at all of one piece of you.
That's exquisite, and the arrows are just exquisite condition.
Bundles of 24. And those are nine different woods, but most of them are poplar.
That is
so the great thing about having so many of a single type of object is you can look at diversity within that, and then you can predict draw weight and you can look at range.
Do you know what this makes? You know what that chess makes me think of? Do you remember Anne Boleyn?
But you see, she'd have had to be on her side because it's not wide enough to actually fit. I know she was fairly petite.
Yes.
That's not one that you don't you reenact one of the...
It's
not Anne Boleyn,
is
it?
Yes.
Oh, is it? Oh, yes. Well, you're quite petite. Yes. But I assure you, you wouldn't be able to get in lying down flat with your hands. You'd have to be... But they're a lot deeper than they look. Yeah. We're standing looking at the top of it. But you would have had to have been on your side, my dear.
Well, that's an interesting thought, isn't it? So I think that brings us to the end of our tour. I'm wowed and amazed, and I could spend hours here. I can't take my eyes off the ship. And some of the artifacts are just... Guys, you've got to come and see this place. It's amazing. If you love Tudor history, then this place is just dripping with it. Thank you so much to John and to Alex for showing us around here today. But before we go, I just wanted to ask you, you know, what have you got coming up, and how can people find out about how to visit?
The way to find out is to go onto the website. In July, we launched a new experience, which is the 1545, recreating a bit about the Battle of the Solent. So you move out between the ships and you turn and you sink gracefully to the seabed. And that's a wonderful experience together with a history. So you're meeting or you're seeing a life-size Henry VIII talking you through the history of his ship. And then you go into the sinking experience, and then you're out into 1545 with the panorama of the sinking in front of you and the beginning of the new museum. So for October in 2022 marks the 40th anniversary of the raising of the Mary Rose. So we're trying to do something for that, but we're just still finding our feet. But we're interviewing a lot of the people who were there, so we'll have many memories. We're going to have somebody showing a model of the lifting of the Mary Rose, a scale model showing how the various aspects of it, and just come and see it. There's always something happening. We try and do something to the exhibition every year, or perhaps during COVID every second year, and there's always something happening for the children. So we have a children's trail at the moment with chests that they explore and look at things, and we change those every year and try and find something slightly different.
Yes, it's very interactive and it's very family friendly, isn't it? And you were mentioning, in terms of research coming up, what might people could get excited about that might be on the horizon?
Well, I think it's actually finding out more about the individuals and where they came from. We were so excited about the fact that we seem to have such a diverse crew that we're applying for all sorts of grants from various places to get more work done on the genomic DNA in particular. But there are a number of different things that we're doing with the bones as well. So
that's great. And just in case people, you know, coming down here, they're obviously going to spend a lot of time here at Mary Rose because there is a lot to see. But you've also got Southsea Castle, haven't you, for folks that are just wanting to sort of maybe
round out the experience.
Yeah, that's free to the public to enter. You can stand on the ramparts and make sure you bring your binoculars, because you can then just stand on the ramparts and you can see the wreck site from the ramparts.
That's amazing, isn't it? How far away is it from the museum? Does people have to drive? Can they walk?
There's buses from the Hard Interchange. So many buses that go down to South Parade and you go past the castle there. So
easy public transport.
Very
with
easy.
A little bit of planning.
You can, if you're travelling by car, you could get a taxi down there. It's about a 40-minute walk.
Okay, right. Lovely. So, well, thank you. I just have to say thank you so much again. It's been such a delight.
You're welcome.
I've learned so much, and I'm
very
like,
much,
wow. And now, you know, it'd be lovely to go around again.
Psst. Before we finish the show, remember you can support my work via my Patreon programme, where various levels of sponsorship are available, starting at just $1 a month. Check out all the details of how to become a patron in the link included with this podcast. Oh, and don't forget, you can be part of my closed Facebook group where fellow time travellers like you hang out with me and each other to share some of our favourite things about visiting the UK. From great Tudor places to visit, to the best way to take your cream tea in an afternoon. From the latest travel news to the traditional Sunday roast. So don't miss out, and you can apply to join by clicking on the link in the description. So now it's back to close the show. Well, my friends, I hope you enjoyed that exhilarating tour of the Mary Rose Museum. If you love Tudor history, I defy you to find a better collection of Tudor objects anywhere in the UK. It really is an incredible insight to the lives of our forefathers some 500 years ago. Now, if you are thinking about visiting the Mary Rose Museum, I've done a little bit of exploring on your behalf, particularly for those of you who are less familiar with getting around the UK who may be visiting from overseas. I suspect if that's the case, you're probably coming from London and you can get a train directly from London's Waterloo Station to Portsmouth Harbour for around £9.20. So US dollars wise, we'd be looking, what, about 13 US dollars. That's for a single ticket one way. So very, very accessible by train. If you wanted to drive, it's equally easy to get to. It's just under 2 hour drive directly from London down the A3. And if you're in the area, particularly if you have a car, there are some other very interesting Tudor places to visit. One of those is Southampton, which is just a little bit westwards along the coast. That was a place that was visited, for example, by Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn during their 1535 progress. You'll still see one of the old medieval gateways to the city. And there is a rather interesting Tudor house, literally called Tudor House and Gardens, which my co-author and I of In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn postulate possibly was one of the places visited by Henry and Anne during their visit to Southampton. Other places that we have in the area, well, Winchester is not too far northwest, very accessible, again, if you have a car. And of course, Winchester was a place that Mary Tudor married Philip of Spain. And you can still, of course, visit the cathedral and the ruins of the Bishop's Palace, which is where they stayed and they had their wedding banquet, which is directly adjacent to it. You also have, for example, Mottisfont Abbey in the area. That was visited by Edward VI on his progress. And Bishop's Waltham, not too far away from Winchester, contains the ruins of the Bishop's Palace. And again, that was a place that was stayed in by Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII during their 1535 progress. So there are quite a few areas down. We're talking in Hampshire here, around the area that if you have some mobility, it would be really easy to visit. Okay, well, you may have some other favourites to visit in Hampshire. And if you do, of course, you can let me know at sarah@thetudortravelguide.com. Okay, well, I think that's it for today's episode. As I said, I do hope you enjoyed and you can make your visit to the Mary Rose soon. Certainly plan it into your itinerary. So it's a big thanks from me to our hosts today. And that was, of course, Alex and John from the Mary Rose Museum and to all the staff at the Mary Rose Museum who helped me organise this trip and record this podcast and made us so welcome. So, my friends, it's goodbye from me. And of course, I'll see you next month on another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.